And now your host of California MUFON Radio, Laurian Fenton.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the California MUFON Radio Show. I'm your host, Laurian Fenton. I'm so glad you're here with us tonight. It's going to be a very interesting evening. Our guest this evening is James Bartley, and he is an amazing UFO alien investigator that... Boy, he has so many experiences, I don't even know where to start. But before we talk to James tonight, I'd just like to let everybody know about a meeting coming up at the LA MUFON next Tuesday night. Not next Tuesday night. It'll be Tuesday the 20th of November, and that will be... If you go to MUFON, MUFONLA.com, you can see the schedule and the meetings. They have past meetings and current meetings coming up. And Tuesday, November 20th at 8 p.m. will be Michael Cremo. He's going to be talking about accounts of spacecraft in the text of ancient India. And that covers the Vimanas, that's correct. And that's the Sanskrit text of ancient India and the Vimanas. So that's going to be a very interesting evening for everybody down in L.A. And Michael's a wonderful presenter. I've seen him many times. He's just fabulous, and he's on Ancient Aliens, as we all know. So that'll be a wonderful, wonderful meeting to go to for everyone. And I want to thank our last presenter at a Marin Sonoma MUFON last Saturday. The gentleman was Rob States, and he has presented at LA MUFON and I believe at the Orange County MUFON as well. And Rob is just an amazing presenter. So any other MUFONs out there that need a guy that can talk about spacecraft and aliens all over the galaxy with a plume and with a panache, you need to really get a hold of Mr. Rob States, and you can contact me here at the California MUFON Radio Show to get his information and have him come to your place of meeting, because the guy's wonderful. So anyhow, I'd like to just touch upon one other thing here. There's going to be an event where Michael Cremo is going to be presenting in Los Angeles coming up on November 16th, 17th, and 18th. It's called Alchemy Event. You can go to alchemyevent.com, and Michael will be there and a few other speakers of interest, and some MUFON people will be there. It's going to be a very wonderful weekend, and I hope that anybody in LA that is coming home for the holidays could come and join us there. It's going to be very interesting, and a lot of information about UFOs, aliens. Barbara Lamb will be there. She's another person that is very connected to MUFON. So I hope you do show up if you're in the LA area. Well, without further ado, I'm going to bring James Bartley on, and I need to go to my screen to let you know a little bit more about James here. James Bartley formerly worked in an intelligence-related capacity for U.S. Naval Air Forces, Nav Air. He is an independent historian with an emphasis on intelligence, counterintelligence, and special operations. He is a student of military history from antiquity to modern times and has made an in-depth study of the military, industrial, financial, security complex, which developed after World War II. James was also a longstanding protege and confidant of the late great Barbara Bartholik, and Barbara also mentored the late great Carla Turner. Long before Blog Talk Radio craze, James Bartley hosted his own radio and internet autocast show based out of Tucson, Arizona in the mid to late 1990s. James interviewed a number of well-known individuals in the UFO field, including former MUFON International Director John, is it Schuessler? Is that how it's pronounced, James?
Schuessler.
Schuessler. I knew I was close.
That's how he pronounced it.
Thank you for that. So there we are, folks. That's just a little bit of all the amazing things that James has done. And is it Barbara Bartholik? Is that how it's pronounced?
Bartholik.
Bartholik. Thank you very much. I'm so terrible with names. I don't know if anybody out there realizes this, but being a radio show host is probably one of the most challenging things for me because I had a severe speech impediment when I was a child. So pronouncing names has always been very, very difficult for me. So I hope the audience will let that slide because I always do ask our guests for, you know, clarification on pronunciations because it's just one of the things I don't do so well. But I try to do the rest of it as best I can. So there we are. So the little true confession there for you. So James, where do you want to start out with today? We have so many things we could talk about. We could talk about aliens and UFOs and your time with the U.S. Naval Air Forces. And where would you like to go? Or Dr. Carla Turner, if you'd like to talk about that.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a bit about what John Schuessler told me when I interviewed him back in the 1990s. He told me that upon becoming director of the International MUFON, he sent out a memo to all of his all of the members of MUFON, all the investigators, encouraging them to begin to take seriously the high strangeness cases, the high strangeness cases, and I would agree with that. In fact, I'm of the mind that I don't believe a legitimate researcher needs to be told to study the high strangeness cases. Those are the cases which provide the most interesting information and come closest to the inner core of the whole UFO alien abduction encounter experience is the high strangeness cases. And people have to remember that it's not just the physical encounters. It's not just the medical procedures done on abductees, for example. There's a whole gamut of aspects to the experience. There's psychic phenomena. There's seemingly ghostly and poltergeist phenomena. There's all kinds of astral dreamscape and deja vu type experiences. So the human being does have a multidimensional capability, and you see this play out in the abduction contact experience. So I really encourage all the researchers out there to really, really go after the high strangeness cases.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because there's such a quandary in MUFON right now, I believe, about, you know, your field investigator, you're out there doing your thing, and then, you know, there's a sighting over a city. And yeah, it's great to run out and get a, you know, firsthand report about it or talk to somebody on the phone and log the incident. And but I agree with you. I think that most of them wait for that big, you know, moment of aha, like, you know, it landed in the front yard and they all came out and talked to us kind of moment to investigate. And there, and as you said, there are so many facets to it. It can go in so many different directions. And, you know, I just agree with you on that. And if Schuessler was you know, a proponent of that, I think that's wonderful. I'm not quite sure where MUFON's going with that right now. I'm not sure if they're actually advocating it as much as they did or are doing so. Because, you know, with the inventive technology that we have, so much easier for people just to do their reports online, you know. So, but yeah, no, I definitely agree with you. I think running out to the cases that have the, you know, like the alien in the backyard are phenomenal. Yeah.
And it's the encounter cases, which we can obtain the most information from. And investigators have to be wary of, like, cherry picking information they obtain from the witnesses, from the people actually having the encounters. Because too often, cherry-picking occurs. It's a term in the intelligence community where an intelligence analyst will sift through reams of data, but will only obtain that information which advances a particular agenda or advances a particular theory, right? And mm-hmm. discards all the rest. And we can't do that because it's the people that are having the experiences. It's the people are perceiving the experiences. The experiences are encompassing them. They're having electromagnetic side effects. They're having enhanced vivid dreams after the experiences in some cases. They're having out-of-body experiences after a close UFO flyby or a close encounter with a non-human entity or entities. So we have to kind of restrain ourselves from choosing what to discard, what to keep. Just listen, let the people talk with a minimum of interruptions, ideally, and let them explain to you exactly what happened in all of its manifestations, their dreams, any kind of poltergeist type activity that happens around homes. I know that in my own personal experience, I've had alien abduction experiences with negative beings, but I've also had positive encounters with non-human intelligences. And some of these I wouldn't even categorize as extraterrestrial. They're perhaps interdimensional. It's not mutually exclusive. There are some who say it's either or. No, it's an understanding of the ether really is required. These beings are not limited by the speed of light. So when one has encounters, they begin to experience strange phenomena. For example, I went through a phase where I was losing things and things would mysteriously reappear. I had an experience where I was moving furniture around in my bedroom and I had this bottle opener, and I still do. I've had it for over 20 years. It looks like a totem pole. And I set the bottle opener down. I set the bottle opener down onto the center of my desk after I'd opened a brew, and I began moving stuff around and arranging things. And, you know, I don't guzzle beer. I sip it. And so after a while, I finished my beer and I reached over and the bottle opener was gone. Well, what I did was I kind of got compulsive about it. Long story short, I moved the mattress out of the room. I moved the box springs out of the room. I moved a lot of the furniture out of the way, and I searched every conceivable place. And then I decided, well, I don't know. I don't have it, but I'm going to drink another beer. So I went to the kitchen, grabbed a can opener that has a little bottle opener hinge at the back of it, walked back into my bedroom, and the totem pole was sitting right on the center of the desk. Okay. See, and another example from my past where I used to leave a chair sitting by my bed, and I would sit up in my bed and read, and I would put a glass in the center of the chair. And then as I'm reading, I'd reach over and drink out of the glass. And I was reading, I remember distinctly, I was reading the memoirs of Field Marshal Erich von Manstein, an outstanding commander of the German army in World War II. And I just about finished reading a chapter. I reached over to grab the glass on the center of the chair, and then the glass seemed to jump off the chair and fall down onto the carpet. Now, there was only a small amount of water and little bits of ice in the bottom of the glass. It was nothing sticky. It was nothing that was going to make a mess. So, you know, by that time also, I'd had so many unusual experiences that I just blew it off. So I didn't immediately lean over and reach down and grab the chair. I just decided to finish reading the chapter, right? And so I get to the end of the chapter, and I decide, okay, I start to stop being lazy. And then I start to roll over and reach down to grab the glass, and there it is sitting on the center of my chair. And I immediately reached down to the carpet and felt around. There was no moisture whatsoever. So How does one categorize that experience? Is that a ghostly experience? Is that a poltergeist experience? Is it part and parcel of the ET contact phenomena? So we cannot discard that because it doesn't fit into a certain paradigm or fit into a certain box. These are the kind of things that happen to people who are going through a cycle of high intensity and frequency of contacts. Whether they're psychic, whether they're telepathic, whether they're you're being hit by a spate of UFO dreams where you're having a number of sightings or actual encounter experiences or all of the above. So yeah, so we have to listen to the people.
Yeah, no, I totally hear you. And I'm pretty sure that MUFON takes down all those pieces into their reports. I mean, from the ones I've read, they do.
That's good.
Yeah. I mean, we're pretty good about that. Whether we have a whole study on that, I'm not sure. I know we have studies on certain aspects of the abductions going on, but I'm just not sure if that's part of it right now. And it may have been in the past, and I'm just not aware of it. But what I want to ask you about these two experiences that you had with the totem pole bottle opener, the first one, the bottle opener, do you think that they actually can make you phase out an item so you can't see it? Do you think that's what's going on? Because I'm beginning to wonder, because I used to have that same phenomenon happen to me. And it would happen quite frequently with my car keys, knowing full well I hung them on the hook by the door. And I had seen them all morning walking in and out of the hallway I was in, knowing they're there. And then I'm getting ready to leave and I reach over to that hook and they are gone. And I start searching everywhere for them. And finally, what I used to end up having to do was scream at the top of my lungs and say, "Put my car keys back," because I thought I had a ghost in the house. And they would end up, I'd leave the room, and they would end up in the middle of the rug in the living room floor.
Yes. There is a trickster aspect to this.
Yeah, there's a weird thing. And then the same thing used to happen with these hair barrettes I used to have to wear when I was a ballerina. I'd have to put my hair up and get ready to go to the theater or whatever. And lo and behold, I'd be looking for those two darn barrettes, and they were always in the same place in the bathroom, of course. I mean, a couple of times, yeah, maybe I slept with them on the couch and they fell out and that's where they were and whatever. But that was very different than reaching for them, knowing you'd seen them 2 hours earlier in that spot. And then finding them again in the middle of the living room floor, stacked on top of each other, perfectly aligned, you know. I mean, it's different than them dropping out of your hair, you know. So
yeah, and there's a trickster aspect, and you know, some of these beings seem to manifest a sense of humor because they can read our minds. They, as my mentor Barbara Bartholik used to say, they know us molecule by molecule. To give you another example, I still do, but I used to really have kind of a compulsive way of parking. I had to parallel park exactly right. It had to be just the perfect distance from the curb, right? And one time after an abduction, I was driving out of my friend's place. I'd walked out of his house because we used to work swing shift in Milpitas. I'm an old Bay Area guy, and I lived in the South Bay for many years, San Jose. And I worked in the semiconductor industry in Milpitas, just north of San Jose. I dropped my buddy off at his place and hung out for a bit. Was watching the beginning of the Tonight Show monologue. And I walked out on the monologue, went to my car. Now, I only lived about, say, 300 meters as the crow flies for my friend's house. But in order to get there, when I pull out of the parking apartment complex parking area, in order to get to my place, I had to cross a double line, okay, basically break the law. So I got used to as I pulled out onto the street from the parking lot, I would always look over to my left to make sure there was no one making a right turn. And that was the last thing I remember. Okay. Remember, I just walked out of the Johnny Carson monologue. I think Jay Leno was on by then. and got into my car. It's a short drive. I can do it in my sleep. Look to my left to make sure there's no one coming and there's no cops around, by the way, because I just want to shoot across a double line, boogie off 300 yards home. Everybody does it, okay? Well, that was the last thing I remember, was looking over to my left to see that there was no traffic coming my way. I awoke with a start, perfectly parked in my front yard. The first thing I did was I looked at the keys. They were set to the opposition in the ignition. I looked to my left. I saw the house across the street. Then I looked to my right, and I saw my house, right? And it took me a while to get out of the car because my whole body felt like a big block of stone, and I felt electrical currents like shooting up and down my body. And this was like September 1990. I just come back from abroad, and I had a series of experiences. And immediately I knew something of an ET UFO nature happened, although back then I was not an active researcher. Although I did read about the subject, I was starting to have all these experiences again. I was in that cycle again. So after a while, I mustered up the courage to get out of the car. I got out of the driver's seat. I'm all stiff. You can imagine me walking crab-like. And I, the moment I got out of the car, I instinctively looked up into the sky, looked all around. The neighborhood was dead quiet. And lo and behold, my Roadrunner was perfectly parked on the, away from the curb. And here's another aspect of the trickster, kind of jokester aspect of it. Although a lot of the stuff with the negative ETs is not really funny. I finally get back to my bedroom, and like a lot of abductees, for a long time I slept with the lights on. It's kind of a comfort zone. And eventually what happens is a lot of people use night lights to kind of wean themselves off that, right? And so back then, because I was going through a spate of a lot of experiences, right, I had one of those power sticks that had a lot of things plugged into it at once. People used to say about
power strip.
That when I turned my power on, everything would come on, my telly, my radio, and everything else, my lights. So I made my way into the house, right, and I'm still looking up and looking around. My body feels like it's made out of cement, and I still feel these electrical currents coursing through me. I get to my bedroom. I flip on the power stick. The lights come on. The stereo starts blasting out, and the song that's blasting out of my stereo, Lights Out by the rock and roll band UFO. You see, so things they were big. If those of you remember back in the 70s, UFO was pretty big back then. Anyway, so So there's some aspects of this that, you know, have there's. You know, you derive whatever humor or black humor out of any given situation, right? It's kind of what keeps a lot of us on an even keel. And the point that I'm making behind all this is that the encounter experience is where the rubber meets the road. Rather than the lights in the sky type of research, the months apart, lights in the sky, track down, you know, witnesses to a 3-week-old UFO sighting. Rather than do that, find out where the high density UFO activity is. And there's going to be underground ET bases. There's going to be active portals and stargates where UFOs fly in and out of. There's going to be active portal entries in the homes of people, right? Having these experiences, and they can have a number of portals in their home. So rather than do like what the Bigelow Foundation did, and they would go to the Skinwalker Ranch with all their sensors and all their electronic equipment, which the entities just mess with and, you know, turn on and off at will, right? When I go into a place that has a lot of activity, a lot of suspected portal activity, either I go in alone or with a friend, or if it's a larger kind of area, I'll go with a small team. All of us will have had experiences. All of us, to one degree or another, will be what you would call psychics. Some, I would have at least one or two people that are basically mediums, right?
Sure.
And these are the kind of people I would go in to, like a Skinwalker Ranch situation, because a lot of people with a scientific background, and first of all, it's not even the real science, it's what Professor James McCanney calls the tier two science is what they teach in the universities, but is not what is taught in the breakaway civilization or understood in the breakaway civilization. Too many people with that kind of a bogus scientific background, there's going to be an element of fear involved. There's no getting around it because they're fearful of seeing something that's confounding to their senses. They're fearful of seeing something that they won't be able to quantify or measure or put into a theoretical framework, right? And see, just putting out that vibe of that uncertainty, I don't want to be around people like that. I want to be around people that have had the experiences, that are veterans of the cosmic wars. Those are the people that I work with. And a lot of the places, the houses we go into, they have active portal entries where reptilians and other energies come out of. Because unlike the big name abduction researchers who promote what I call the gray areas of abduction encounter research, as Dr. Carla Turner and my mentor Barbara Bartholik pointed out, the encounter experiences are extremely varied. A lot of the experiences happen right in one's own bed. They don't have to be abducted or taken anywhere. They don't have to be taken on board of a ship and examined. There's a whole gamut of experiences. There's training. There's behavior modification. There's astral dreamscape manipulation.
Yes, yes. Very interesting. You know, you're talking about this now. Do you actively lead teams out right now and do any UFO investigation or alien abduction investigation?
In the recent past, yes. I've gone to places where there's high, UFO activity, portals, stargates, craft flying in and out of, or places that are suspected underground, undersea bases. That's where the rubber meets the road. Because there's always going to be flap areas, and it could be for electromagnetic, vortex purpose reasons. Like for example, I mentioned Milpitas earlier, Calaveras Reservoir. For some of your listeners there, that's a high UFO activity area. There's a place in the South Bay where I used to live, known as the East Foothills, right? There's military activity there. There's UFO activity there. There's strange underground noise activity there. You go where the phenomenon is, and that's just the way to do it, rather than waiting for sightings to come along every few months.
Yeah. No, I get that. I'm pretty sure that MUFON's got, they've got their star team investigators that go to, I think, the big cases or, the places where 400 people have seen an incident or things like that. I'm pretty sure they're out there doing their magic. So in the meantime, we need to take a break. So we'll be back in just a few minutes, folks. Stay with us with James Bartley here on the California MUFON Radio Show. We'll be right back.
You're listening to IRN, the Inception Radio Network, Chicago, Illinois.
Hello, everyone tuning in. This is Jamie Havigan for Inception Radio Network. Remember to like our Facebook page. Simply go to facebook.com/Inception Radio Network. And help us out by sharing that link on your Facebook page, your Twitter, and let's build our membership. And if you truly like the shows we have, then help us spread the word. Help us get likes. Facebook.com/Inception Radio Network. I'll see you there.
The Mutual UFO Network was established in 1969 as a nonprofit volunteer organization dedicated to the scientific study of UFOs for the benefit of humanity. MUFON's goals are to objectively investigate UFO sightings and collect the data in the MUFON database for use by researchers worldwide, and to educate the public on the UFO phenomenon and its potential impact on society. The Mutual UFO Network is recognized as the leading UFO research and investigative organization on the planet, thanks to MUFON's vast network of dedicated volunteers, like-minded individuals who share the same interest in being part of a group that has brought UFO investigations into the new millennium. Are you interested in becoming a member of MUFON? there's never been a better time to join the network. So for more information, log on to MUFON.com. That's www.MUFON.com.
You didn't forget what's coming up tonight, did you? Hi, Inception Radio Network listeners, this is Amanda. Never miss that interview you were looking forward to or the show on your favorite topic. Follow IRN on Twitter, I_R_N, and get reminders about the evening's live shows as well as fun and important updates throughout the week. That's I_R_N, and never miss a great show again.
Don't have a computer? Is your internet connection down? Don't worry. Use your trusty landline or cell phone and dial or call and listen lines at 832-280-0830 or 786-837-2262 to listen to the Inception Radio Network 24/7. Again, those numbers are 832-280-0830 or 786-837-2262. For the Inception Radio Network, I'm MJ.
Everyone, welcome back to the California MUFON Radio Show. I'm your host, Lorian Fenton, and with us tonight is my special guest, James Bartley. And James and I were just discussing a myriad of things about investigations and the trickster aspect of the alien abduction phenomena and quite a few other little tidbits of information for you folks. So with that, James, are you there with us?
Yes, I'm here, Lorian.
Wonderful. So, James, would you like to speak a little bit more about, you talk about a bilocation experience, but I was wondering, have you ever had any dealings with MUFON? I forgot to ask that question at the beginning of the show today.
Well, like any organization, you're going to come across people that are really high caliber, top shelf, and then like any organization, there's varying, you know, degrees of ability, competency, whatever you want to call it. I've had the good fortune of being around some outstanding MUFON researchers. Bill Hamilton of Southern California, and for a while I lived in the Phoenix area. I helped him move. I've always regarded him as one of the top UFO researchers in the field. He was an actual member of the so-called contactee movement in the 1950s and 60s, and that is an aspect of ufology which needs to be reevaluated, the contactee era, because to this day there are countless people around the world who are having encounters with beings who look perfectly human, and I emphasize the word perfectly pointedly, because they seem to have a mastery of genetics. Their faces are perfectly symmetrical, no blemishes, no freckles, no nothing, and a lot of the things that the contactees told people, or rather the human-looking ETs told the contactees in the old days, well, a lot of them panned out, okay? A lot of them did. And, yeah. You know, mainstream ufology, especially in ICAP, went out of their way to discredit those people. But Bill was part of that.
Sure, and we're talking about the giant rock era with George Adamski and that.
George, yeah. And George Van Tassel, and Bill has had his own contact experiences too, quite phenomenal ones. If one ever has a chance to sit down and talk to him, he talks a bit about his contact experiences with human looking ETs in the Kerry Cassidy interview on Project Camelot.
But oh, wonderful!
But Bill's also been a pioneer in researching the deep black military aerospace ET connection. For many years, Bill lived in the Antelope Valley, also known as Aerospace Valley, Palmdale, yeah. Lancaster, places like that. And he sure. developed a number of sources in the underground bases, Edwards, China Lake, as well as the aerospace corporations there. And he developed a lot of sources, and he networked with a group of people there, and they came out with a lot of critically important information, especially for that era. And it validated a lot of the information that Paul Benowitz came up with. Paul Benowitz, the debunkers and the gatekeepers, went out of their way to discredit and destroy his life. But Paul Benowitz, for those of you listening, he was the independent scientist who was keeping track of the ET underground base activity at Archuleta Mesa, not too far from the Kirtland Sandia complex. And getting back to Bill Hamilton, Bill developed a number of sources in the underground bases who, as a matter of fact, some of his sources confirmed information that the human-looking ETs gave to the discredited so-called contactees way back when, that some okay. of the really advanced ET races, that their technology is organic, that the craft are grown in a chemical bath, the craft begin to differentiate as they grow, and the ETs, the occupants, have a psychic telepathic link with the technology, right? So right. a lot of that was what the contactees were saying. And Bill had married Pam Hamilton, and she's had a lot of abduction experiences too. And I always looked up to Bill. He was always one of the outstanding researchers out there. Another great MUFON researcher who I never had the pleasure of meeting was Leonard Stringfield, the late, great Leonard Stringfield, who was a true pioneer.
Yes.
And what people have to understand is, and this goes all the way back to NICAP, after Major Donald Kehoe, the founder of NICAP, was ousted, and then all the board members of NICAP wound up being people with known ties to the intelligence community. There has been a longstanding anti-alien bias in what I call mainstream ufology. The lights in the sky stuff is fine. That's acceptable. But you start talking about actual encounters with non-human or human-looking ETs, well, suddenly you're crossing into, like, taboo territory. This is exactly what happened to Larry Warren, who I still consider to be the most important witness from the Bentwaters-Rendlesham affair. And why Larry Warren is always demonized, why the documentarians always pick the other limited hangout witnesses against Larry Warren is simply because Larry Warren is the only one who's come out and said that there is a landed craft, occupants seen outside of the craft, interaction between the military and the occupants of said craft, which is no different from countless other examples of landed craft occupants seen outside of craft. There's a classic book out there edited by Charles Bowen, goes back quite a few years, called The Humanoids, which is chock full of examples of landed craft occupants seen outside of the craft, just exactly what Larry Warren described. But, well, Larry Warren was vilified by the UFO community. And getting back to Leonard Stringfield, when Stringfield's sources began telling him about crash retrievals of alien craft, of bodies of non-human entities recovered in these crash retrievals, and these alien bodies being sequestered at various air bases, sometimes in deep freeze conditions, his most vociferous critics, predictably, were from within the UFO community, right? And
of
we
course.
See this again and yeah. again. We see this again and again, even with Roswell. Roswell is the case that makes the case, and I don't need to go into it. But the fact that there are still people in the UFO community who call themselves UFO researchers who debunk Roswell, right? Roswell is the case that makes the case. Out of Roswell and probably crash retrievals before and after it is how the breakaway civilization came into being, along with other things like so-called treaties and arrangements, whatnot, with non-human civilizations and deep black elements of the military, aerospace, scientific community. Well, Leonard Stringfield was a pioneer in that regard. Leonard Stringfield I don't think still has gotten the credit he deserves for being a pioneer. And the UFO community not only should hold him up as one of the heroes of right up there on the on Mount Olympus pantheon of UFO investigators, but
sure.
But it's an object lesson of what happens when someone comes along and pushes the boundary further and further out, like my friend Dr. Carla Turner did, like my mentor Barbara Bartlett did. Right? They push the envelope out, and then the reaction comes from the mainstream. So, and again, it's cherry picking. It's picking and choosing what fits into one's own paradigm or one's own understanding. Like, for example, nobody could accuse me of being an airy fairy, new age la di da. My feet is planted firmly on the ground. When I worked at Naval Air Force, Pacific Fleet, when the F-14 Delta pilots sitting at the F-14 desk needed certain types of information, they came to me. When certain people in the electronic warfare community needed certain types of information, they came to me. All right. And not only that, though, I'm a student of military history. I knew more about the history of that base, that command, how it fitted into the overall scheme of things than probably anyone at that air base. Right. Because that's what I do. I'm an independent historian. I don't take most academics. I don't take most historians seriously because they will not connect the dots. They will not go up to a certain point. Anything beyond is a conspiracy theory. So I don't even take most historians seriously. Okay. And so getting back to the whole field of ufology, we have to take the raw data and we have to sift through it. And then we have to start making calculated, educated guesses. But educated guesses based on a real groundwork, a real bedrock of information. And without Leonard Stringfield, I don't know, ufology may have been set back like X number of years, right? So that's another pioneer. And I've met a lot of MUFON researchers locally in San Diego and the Bay Area who were outstanding. Ruben Uriarte, he probably doesn't remember me, but he and I had an interesting conversation at a conference in San Mateo back in the 90s. And I've always really respected his work. I've always wanted to sit down with him and hear his take on the crash retrievals, down south of the border, just across the Rio Grande from Texas.
Right. I can arrange that for you. As a matter of fact, we can do a live two-on-two here or one-on-one, in the near future, because Ruben is my Northern California state director. I don't think they call him section director. I think he's a Northern California state director, and he's a wonderful guy. And yes, he is an amazing researcher. And him and Nori Torres are an amazing team, I'll tell you.
And Ruben's done a lot of great work with the crop circles too, and he's spent a lot of time there. I mean, he's really put his heart and soul into this effort. And he and I had an interesting conversation about the East Foothills, right? Because I mentioned to him all the activity there, and he was well aware of it. So, there's a lot of really good researchers in MUFON, a lot of good investigators, many of whom have experiences, and some of them that I've met. And I think this goes for people throughout the UFO community, especially with males. I found this where there's a lot of males who don't want to admit publicly, and maybe not even to themselves, that they've had these experiences, right? These encounter experiences.
Sure.
So they really get involved with all these other aspects of ufology, but they kind of, keep the whole encounter thing somewhat at arm's length. If I've described any of you listening, I really encourage you to embrace your experiences. You can reach people. You can uplift people in ways that I never can, because you are who you are, and you'll be able to relate to people that I won't be able to relate to. So, the time is now to take ownership of this, because what I see developing, and we can shift to other subjects, but the powers that be are trying to put a priesthood back into operation. And we're seeing it with this limited hangout, love fest regarding Area 51 and the Smithsonian Institute recently with all these ex-military guys. Right.
Right.
Nick Pope coming along saying that, any civilian who has reports a UFO encounter, that guy's a Joe Sixpack. In his words, he describes anyone who's a non-military, i.e. a non-officially vetted person, as being a Joe Sixpack. But these ex-military guys, they're the experts. But of course, they're going to keep it at a lights in the sky level. They're not going to talk about the real hardcore stuff, right? And this notion of what's going on now, Gordon Duff with Veterans Today is coming out with all this information about a war between the ETs and humanity. Again, it's putting out this meme that the military, they're the experts. Don't listen to the civilians. They're a bunch of whack jobs. All the videos on YouTube, online. This is what Gordon Duff said. He said that most of them are all hoaxes, right? Only military people are qualified to venture. That's a talking point that comes out again and again with debunkers and gatekeepers. The notion of the unqualified UFO witness, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have to watch out for these people because they're trying to create this priesthood once again. And this notion of the military, or rather ETs and UFOs interacting with the military or getting involved with dogfights in the military, that's old as ufology itself. I mean, the books that Timothy Good wrote, the great books that Richard Dolan wrote, are full of examples of a military interest in UFOs and non-human life forms. So this whole concept of, they're invading. We need to rely on the military to protect us, give away more of our power, always look to the experts. No, we don't have to do that. And because a lot of the information that Gordon Duff came out, that's not only is it limited hangout, but it's not exactly news to those of us who lived in Southern California. Undersea UFO bases off the coast of California, we've known about that for decades. Catalina Island, San Clemente, off the coast of San Diego. I could tell you stories of all kinds of military activity, just jets and helos flying all over the place in a frenzy because of all the UFO activity off the coast of San Diego. I used to live there. And so that's not exactly news.
Yeah,
so.
No, that's interesting. So, James, what I'm hearing you say is that it's the upper echelon military government agencies that maybe are trying to just not take anything that just regular folks are saying at face value, or that, it's not important, or that they're creating a hierarchy of people that are allowed to look at the UFO phenomenon. And I'm not saying that in the context of MUFON, because I think MUFON does a really great job of training their investigators. I mean, they have
MUFON's done a great job.
And yeah, they have to take a test. I mean, it's not like they're just willy-nilly running out there doing it. They have to really pass some muster to get there. So,
it's not just the American MUFON investigators. It's the MUFON correspondents, the great Dr. Olivo Fontes of Brazil, I think it was. Just outstanding research in the 1950s and 60s out of Brazil. He was the go-to guy, and he was basically a MUFON international correspondent. So it's around the world. The MUFON deserves tons of credit for really pushing the envelope in certain areas, right?
Exactly. And I'm hearing that from you. But but on the other side of the coin, we've got this whole military complex, I'm hearing you say, that are really just trying to suppress the lower echelon type people, or just the people that are saying, hey, I've got aliens coming through a portal in my bedroom and a UFO landing in my backyard all the time, right? That they have to control what's actually getting out to the public, in other words.
Yes, because there's this ongoing meme that's pushed out of aliens invading and the military having to, defend humanity. But people have been having encounter experiences from day one. So it's not exactly news to the people who are having the experiences. They've been successfully marginalized. Right. Because I go back again and again and again to the Robertson panel, CIA, 1953, where the official policy of debunking sightings by academics, paid academics, by the way, and ridiculing witnesses by the controlled corporate media. It always goes back to that. And so I'm always suspicious of those people who are supposed to be independent UFO investigators, but they seem to have a symbiotic link to them, to controlled corporate media. They seem to be the go-to guy, right? For example, let me give you an example of that. Like Glenn Campbell for many years was the media's go-to guy at Rachel, Nevada, where
that's
little
true.
Alien. Okay, yeah. I've lectured at the UFO friendship campouts and at the little alien, and so have my friends. And there's been some great whistleblowers there over the years. Bill Uhouse, a former engineer who's worked on a, you know, alien flight simulator. I'm sure a lot of your people, listeners and members are familiar with that story. Bob Lazar actually gave a talk there one time at the little alien. Well, what was happening was there was just too much attention being drawn to that little corner of the Nevada desert, right? So what
right.
happens is suddenly a guy named Glenn Campbell pops up and he sets up his own little shop. He, you know, he sells souvenir UFO mugs, Area 51 paraphernalia, whatnot. And every time the media showed up to Rachel, it was Glenn Campbell they interviewed every time. And he would be there dressed in his desert camos. Right. And he
had. Didn't he live in a trailer right outside of town? I mean,
yeah,
right.
Well, basically, yeah. they were all trailers there. When you see the X-Files episode of Rachel being this bedroom community with multi-million dollar homes. No, it's not like that back then. I don't know what it's like now. Back then, it was just a bunch of trailers. But so
exactly.
He had his trailer. And then it was like an opposition to the Rachel a bar and grill, which was later renamed Little Alien, great patriotic American couple, Joe and Pat Travis. I can't say enough. Joe has passed over. What a great man he was. Pat Travis, I don't know what's happened to her. I heard, you know, I don't know what her health is like. I don't know if she's still, you know, on this side of, you know, things, but they did a great thing with all of their UFO friendship campouts. Always on Labor Day or always on the 4th of July, some big 3-day weekend. But the media would always show up and interview Glenn Campbell. And Glenn
right.
Campbell would say, I'm here 24/7, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. I've never seen nothing, right? Now, I've
exactly.
been there. I've been there, and I've seen six luminescent elliptical-shaped craft fly out of the test site and fly right over my head at low altitude. Zigzagging over my head.
Wow.
Weaving in and out without colliding into each other. And I stood right beneath that, right? And other people have seen all kinds of stuff. Jordan Maxwell has a story where he got lost and went to a place he intended to go out to, like the Groom Road, but he went in another direction. And then, like, a number of large craft flew out of a cloud bank right down, you know, hovering right over him and scared the bejesus out of him and another
yeah,
guy named Paul.
Yeah,
so.
No, he's going to be on my show pretty soon, so we'll have to get that story out of him again. Yeah.
Yeah, Jordan Maxwell is an outstanding researcher and a true hero. And anyway, so
yeah,
I'm always wary of people who seem to be the go-to guy to the media, right? Every time there's some kind of big UFO event, oh, they go to, you know, so-and-so, and then he kind of explains it in, you know, inconclusive terms, right? And they always talk about how, well, you know, those lights in the sky, months apart investigations, they'll never lead anywhere. And that's the way that the powers that be want it. And now what they're doing is they're setting up things so that all these ex-military people are the only legitimate authority to voice as far as UFOs and whatnot are concerned, never mind the countless average everyday people who have these experiences. And so people should watch for this pattern of all these ex-military people popping up. And because, for example, these people that are coming out now talking about wars between, you know, the military and ETs. Well, that's not exactly news to all the pilots who've, you know, been involved in UFO chases and crashed over the years, right? All the people
right.
who have been harassed by deep black elements of the military intelligence community, all the people who've been bumped off and disappeared over the years, it's not news to them or their families or people who have been ridiculed and harassed, right? So I take exception
yeah.
to these people trying to big shot everybody and say, we're the experts, everyone else is crazy.
Right, yeah. You know, it brings up the whole black and dark aspect of this whole thing that, you know, I try to cover, but, you know, it's such a, you know, such uncharted territory, James. You know, it's like, what do we do about it, you know?
Well,
I think Carla was probably a really good example of somebody who was skirting the, you know, the black elements of the whole UFO community.
Oh, yes. And so was Barbara Bartholik, because Barbara mentored Candy Turner, her friends. And all those elements of all the wide variety of entities that oftentimes work in unison with one another, not just grays or hybrid variants of grays. They're just a bewildering variety of ETs. Some of them look quite human. And what I can talk about. What I can talk about after the break is the primary role the reptilians play in a lot of the negative abduction experiences. There is a controlling factor.
I think we should go into that.
Yeah.
I didn't really want to, but you know what? It's time, because you know, there is a place for that, and people need to be, you know, they need to be wakened up to it, that there is the bad side of the whole thing here too. And
well, there's a good side to it. But they didn't want to hear the good side. They didn't want to hear from the contactees. So they can't have it both ways, right? They can't say, well, we don't want to hear about good ETs, but you know, we don't want to hear about bad ETs either. It's like they got to make, you know, that's not scientific, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, do you know about OPUS, the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support, with Lester Velez, who was our assistant MUFON state director for quite a long time?
Oh, I know Lester.
Lester's wonderful. Yeah. And when we come back, we're going to take a break here real quickly, and we'll talk a little bit about the negative reptilians, and then let's talk a little bit positive on the other side, too. How's that sound?
Yeah.
Okay, sounds great. Well, everybody stay with us. We're talking ETs, UFOs, and everything in between here on the California MUFON Radio Show. We'll be right back.
You're listening to IRN, the Inception Radio Network, Chicago, Illinois.
You didn't forget what's coming up tonight, did you? Hi, Inception Radio Network listeners, this is Amanda. Never miss that interview you were looking forward to or the show on your favorite topic. Follow IRN on Twitter, I_R_N. And get reminders about the evening's live shows, as well as fun and important updates throughout the week. That's I_R_N, and never miss a great show again.
The Mutual UFO Network was established in 1969 as a nonprofit volunteer organization dedicated to the scientific study of UFOs for the benefit of humanity. MUFON's goals are to objectively investigate UFO sightings and collect the data in the MUFON database for use by researchers worldwide, and to educate the public on the UFO phenomenon and its potential impact on society. The Mutual UFO Network is recognized as the leading UFO research and investigative organization on the planet, thanks to MUFON's vast network of dedicated volunteers, like-minded individuals who share the same interest in being part of a group that has brought UFO investigations into the new millennium. Are you interested in becoming a member of MUFON? There's never been a better time to join the network. So for more information, log on to MUFON.com. That's www.mufon.com.
Don't have a computer? Is your internet connection down? Don't worry. Use your trusty landline or cell phone and dial or call and listen lines at 832-280-0830 or 786-837-2262 to listen to the Inception Radio Network 24/7. Again, those numbers are 832-280-0830 or 786-837-2262. For the Inception Radio Network, I'm MJ.
Hello, Inception Radio Network listeners. This is Amanda. Remember, you can take your Inception Radio shows on the go. Just download the Inception Radio Network app for your iPhone, iPad, or Android smartphones and access live shows, past shows, guest lineups, and much more. Just visit the iTunes Store or the Google Play Marketplace and download it today for free.
Hey guys, just a quick reminder, make sure you tune in every Wednesday at 11 p.m. Eastern Time for California MUFON Radio, hosted by Lorian Fenton, and will include other MUFON guest hosts. That's every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on Inception Radio Network.
In Alabama, she was swinging a hammer. Price you gotta pay when you break the panorama. She never knew that there was anything more than gold. What in the world does your company take me for? Black bandana, sweet Louisiana, robbing on a bank in the state of Indiana. She's a runner, rebel and a stunner, from the mirror way saying, baby, what you gonna? Looking down the barrel of a hot man.
Welcome back, everybody, to the California MUFON Radio Show here on Inception Radio Network. And I just want to thank everybody for being here tonight. I'm your host, Lorian Fenton, and I'm here tonight with James Bartley. And we were just discussing Opus, and you know, I haven't mentioned this for a while. I think I did on my first show, but anybody out there who calls in to MUFON and they're calling in just about alien abduction or those type of scenarios that have been happening to them, MUFON will probably, more than likely, refer you to OPUS. And OPUS stands for the Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support. And I am trying furiously right now in my search engine to find their new website address for you folks. And I will try to do that in a second. But I just want everybody to know they're out there to help you. And they're MUFON endorsed. So I think everybody should try to get to them if you do have alien abduction incidents that you want to report or that you would like to just talk to a therapist about. They have a bulletin board. They have therapists that go in there and work with abductees. They have therapy if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, where you can actually go see a therapist who understands alien abduction and has worked with it quite a bit. And I think they even have connections in Los Angeles and throughout the West Coast and possibly the East Coast now. I haven't been keeping up on it lately. So if you ever need help in that arena, please get a hold of Opus. And while James is telling us his story, I will try to endeavor to find that website address for you there, folks. So, James, where were we?
Well, we were going to talk about the seminal influence of Barbara Bartholik and Dr. Carla Turner.
And, oh, I'd love to. Yes.
Yeah, and Barbara Bartholik was my mentor, and at a time in my life when I was going through a lot of challenges, ET related, reptilian related, and she really helped me, just as she had helped a lot of other people. And the beautiful thing about Barbie Bartholik was that she had 30 years plus of working closely with abductees, and she didn't censor what her the people she worked with told her. If they wanted to believe that the ETs were all friendly and nice, despite some of the negative things that were happening to them, that was okay with Barbie. She would make up her own mind about the information derived from a
sure.
given person based on her background. She never imposed her will on people, which is important because some of the big-name mainstream abduction researchers do a lot of censorship, quite frankly. And what Barbara did was she pioneered the research into the reptilian abductions, because the reptilians are the controlling factor. They are at the close to the top of the heap, although there are beings behind the reptilians. At the operational level, a lot of these beings, like some factions of the Greys, the Mantis beings, even some of the Nordics, they basically work within a reptilian context. They're each trying to carve out their own niche, all these different ET groups. They've each got their own agenda, but they work within a framework which advances the reptilian agenda. For example, the Greys do a lot of the genetic medical work. Some reptilians do, but they leave that mostly to the Greys, right? And what Barbie mm-hmm. found out very quickly was that a lot of these abductees were describing a number of different beings, mantis beings, Greys, reptilians. And oftentimes the reptilians would try to hide behind the scenes. What a lot of people don't realize is when the aliens impose the externally imposed amnesia and memory erasure, mm-hmm. they set up blocks, they set up shunts. The first screen is for the abductee. The second screen is for the hypnotic regressionist. And a lot of these hypnotic regressionists, they don't get past the second level. And what usually comes up with a lot of regressionists is the standard medical procedure type experience. And the ab reaction is real because the hidden trauma, the blocked energy, the traumatic energy is still in there. But the way the aliens program the mind of the person is they compel them to relive the standard type of experience, right? And then the researcher, their hypnotic regressionist, not knowing any better, well, this jibes with all these other cases I've worked on. I would say that this is another typical standard abduction scenario when someone who can get past that second level of screen memories can find mm-hmm. out what really went on. And oftentimes what really happens is these people find themselves in an ET installation, maybe underground, maybe off-world, and we'll see not just one type of ET, but different types of ETs, Nordics, mantis beings, tan beings, brown beings. I mean, they look outwardly like a gray wood, except there's slight variances in color or texture and skin, whatnot. And oftentimes, right. overseeing a lot of this would be the reptilians. And now, what I tell people who contact me for the first time is that I give them a standard disclaimer that these entities don't want you talking to me. So if you wake up feeling mistrustful or hostile towards me, I tell the people in an email, that's just them messing with you. So you are dissuaded from contacting me and learning more about your experiences. Ditto, they may mess with your family members and your children and manipulate you in such a way that you want to have no contact with me. And they did the same thing with Candy Turner and Barbara Bartholik. The ETs would mention Candy and Barbie by name like they do to me and say, do not speak to Carla Turner or you're going to be in trouble. We're going to do things to you. Right.
So, right. You know, I don't want to interrupt because you've got a great flow of thought going here, but I just wanted to mention a couple of quick things. A lot of researchers out there are beginning to wonder if this deep form of hypnosis is because they're using chemically induced imprints as well as like the holographic or suggestive imprints that people use in the subconscious, that they might not be tying this to our hormones and other things within our physical structure here in 3D world. Have you heard anything about this at all, or is this just something that's starting to come up?
Yes, that happens. I'll give you an example of my own experience, because they seem to be able to interact with and even medically mess with our astral body, our what the ancient Egyptians call our ka, right?
Right.
What happened with me on a number of instances, but one in particular stands out, where I thought I was having a physical abduction experience. I was on a table. I was in what appeared to be a medical clinic, a small medical clinic, and the entity that was standing before me as I lay on the table, I'll never forget what this entity looked like. And there are others I've spoken to who have described exactly the same thing. This entity was short, had a rumpled gray face, It was dressed in a nurse's uniform. It had a nurse's hat on, and it had a black wig that was askew. It wasn't straight. It was crooked, right? And I was on this table, and I was fussing with this entity. I was trying to get off the entity, get off the table, rather. And the in order to subdue me, this nurse alien kind of like grabbed me like in an unmentionable place, right? And I screamed out in pain. And then it jabbed me in the upper right bicep with a syringe. And I guess another thing, they're constantly extracting fluids and constantly putting in fluids and whatnot into us.
And okay.
The entity left, and then I walked out of the clinic. And I found the clinic to be in the center of a very, very large grassy field, like a horse's paddock, except it was immeasurable. It stretched out in all directions. It was a theater of the mind, pretty much, right? And I remember standing outside of this small clinic, and I was rubbing the puncture wound in my upper bicep. I was feeling the puncture wound with my index finger. And as I'm doing that, my phone starts to ring, right, in my bedroom.
Okay.
And I'm laying there, and I'm thinking, okay, part of me is in this other place feeling this puncture wound with my index finger, my upper right bicep. And there's another part of me that's laying in this bed, and the phone is ringing. So I kind of snapped out of it. I got up and answered the phone. It was an abductee friend of mine. However, the pain in my upper right bicep still hurt as if I'd really been injected, although there was no puncture wound. So they were working on my astral ethereal body, if you will. But
sure.
I felt, and this happens also where they work with parts of our astral body, and we wind up having physical bruises and marks in our physical anatomy when we wake
up. Exactly.
That happens.
Yeah.
That happens too.
Yeah. Very interesting. Boy, we got far afield
there. I don't know
if
I answered your question.
Yeah, no, you did. That's wonderful. Where were we? We were back at Carla and Barbara.
Well, what Candy and Barbara proved was the wide spectrum analysis of the whole abduction syndrome. It wasn't just standard formulaic medical experimentation and then returned. It was far more broad. The people are often taken to underground ET bases on our planet, beneath our planet, rather. And they also found that there was an ongoing interaction between certain ET races and deep black elements of the military, aerospace, medical community. So was going on also.
Now, is this going to be our dark topic for a few minutes here, and then we'll get on to a light one to close out the show?
Oh, yeah. we'll finish up with a crescendo. I just want to give props to Barbie and Candy for being the pioneers. Barbie was a saint. I always likened her to a cosmic combat medic who always – patched up these people, helped them to reintegrate, helped them to get on with their lives. Candy was a true fireball pioneer. I'll never forget her standing there before the 93 International UFO Congress in Las Vegas. She inspired me, right? Because
yeah.
I was going through a pretty dark time during that time period, but she lit a fire under me, so to speak, and inspired me and many others to continue the work. So I honor their memory, and everything I do, I keep them in mind, and I want to give honor to them with the work that I do.
Yes, yeah, they were wonderful. I found them on the YouTube recently, actually, and I was just blown away, absolutely blown away by these women. So, yeah, I don't even know what to say. Let's talk about reptilians. How's that sound?
Well, the reptilians, much is made in, you know, by mainstream abduction researchers, and then we'll switch to the good news, right? Because there is good news.
Yes.
The mainstream abduction researchers would have you believe that the hybrid scenario deals strictly with the grays, but that is not exactly correct. Certainly the grays and factions thereof have this ongoing hybridization program. They're trying to revivify their species with human DNA. I agree with that. But the hybridization problem, aspect we really need to take note of is the long-standing reptilian human hybrid program. And I've spoken at length. For example, a garden variety example of a reptilian human hybrid is a serial killer, because a lot of the neurological aspects of these hybrids, their lack of impulse control, because they have non-existent frontal lobe capacity, which is our impulse control safety net.
Right.
It's like, you know, when the manager of my favorite baseball team takes out an effective pitcher and brings in a lousy reliever, the frontal lobe prevents me from throwing a brick through the TV screen. Okay, that's where the frontal lobe kicks in, right?
Now, yes, what they I understand that.
And what scientists have found studying a particular serial murderer, Joel Rifkin, is that these serial murderers not only lack frontal lobe capacity, but they have little or no control of their bodily movements, which is a recipe for disaster because they have a genetic predisposition to being taken up as a host, right? These reptilian entities can take them over and work through their physical body as a medium with which to mete out, you know, mayhem or whatever to society, right? And for lack of a better term, I call it the David Icke hypothesis, and that's real. Long before a lot of people have heard about David Icke, and he's done great work. There's been people like Barbara Bartholik, myself, Candy Turner, who focused on the reptilian aspect, and a lot of the behavioral programming is done in the astral dreamscape, where these people are hybrids, reptilian and human hybrids, are made to endure these very vivid, sadistic, gory, erotic, whatever the category of hybrid they're trying to create out of the person. They put them through this astral dreamscape manipulation. There's a parallel physical manipulation. They're being manipulated sexually, physically. They're parts of their anatomy are being electromagnetically beamed. For example, the frontal lobe may be getting electromagnetically beamed to, you know, further erode what's left of the frontal lobe capability. And even for people who are not full-on reptilian hybrids, but the reptilians want to push them in a direction where they're more impulsive, more abusive. For example, like a lot of domestic abuse issues where you have controlling, manipulative men and they're meeting out the domestic violence and abuse to a woman, for example. That is an emotional smorgasbord for the reptilian entities, because not only do they work through the male and they promote and they feed his rage, they feed off of the anxiety, the fear of the woman, in our example, getting beaten up, right? And that's how it works, because these negative entities are essentially parasites. They're into emotional and energetic harvesting, and they will strive to destabilize us, disrupt our lives in a myriad ways in order to keep us at a low vibrational ebb. This is why it's important to have a metaphysical outlook and a metaphysical understanding about all this, right? And so keep that in mind, that these hybrids, are reptilian hybrids out there, many of them, you know, wind up becoming big shots and high finance and industrialists, what have you, because that's the nature of the planet we're on, and that's what we're eventually going to overthrow. So to get to the good news before we run out of time, right, because there is a positive message, we human beings, we have, some of us, especially in certain genetic bloodlines, again, it always goes back to bloodlines, right, because these people not only have DNA from one ET race. Some of them have DNA from a number of different races, and there is a latent metaphysical aspect to this DNA. And this is why the ETs often, when they abduct certain people, these abductees manifest metaphysical capabilities in the alien environment. They can levitate, they can interface with ET technology, they can read alien script, they can walk through solid objects, so on and so forth, right? It seems as if, and though it doesn't seem, these ETs are able to use people in certain states of being and certain states of mind to advance their agenda, right? Well, the good news is that a lot of abductees and contactees, because some people have both positive and negative experiences, and some people have mostly positive encounters with benevolent, spiritually evolved aliens and interdimensionals. That happens too. Well, more and more people around the world are coming into a realization of their own metaphysical potential. And it's important for us to not get pulled down into the lower chakras of existence, not allow ourselves to not be turned into really negative people because of the news media and all this other stuff that just keeps reinforcing an essentially negative message, because everything is frequency, everything is vibration. And what's happening is with all these new frequencies and energy streaming into our solar system, we are going to be in perfect alignment. Our star, our sun, is with the galactic center. Dr. Paul Laviolette's work about galactic super waves, you know, streaming in from, you know, the center of our galaxy, that's real, okay? And it's affecting us in a number of ways. If it's going to affect our sun to the point where our sun is having humongous coronal mass ejections, solar flares, etc., well, it's going to affect us because our DNA is liquid crystalline in nature. And if you study the work of Michael Talbot, Holographic Universe Beyond the Quantum, if you study the work of David Bohm, the implicate order, how everything that we see around us actually originates from a hidden unseen realm, a hidden unseen plane. This ties into Richard Hoagland's work of hyperdimensional physics, rotating dynamic torsion physics systems, Professor Nikolai Koryev, the great Russian physicist. Well, all that energy, and we are ourselves, we have chakra systems, an imperfect system to be sure. A fully realized spiritual being should not have a chakra system. I would argue, and many people believe, that the chakra system is a control mechanism, right? Easy to block, easy to place physical and etheric implants. Even negative emotions like resentment, jealousy can block us up energetically and emotionally because we have meridians and ley lines just like the planet does. So
exactly. Yeah.
All that is coming into play, and we really have to regulate our thinking. We have to remove all the distractions and sources of anxiety and distress in our lives. And we really got to practice good mental hygiene, and we have to get out of mind. And by that, I mean we have to get into consciousness where we become intuitive again, right? Because we are essentially intuitive beings. We started out that way a long time ago, but the advent of like alphabet languages imposed by Yahweh and other like gods or demigods, that shunted us into the left brain. And with the left brain came scribes. With scribes came laws and, you know, interpretations. We need to get back to the right side of our brain. We need to get back to our intuitive selves. And
exactly. The
creative side. As long as we put ourselves in the best possible place, spiritually, metaphysically, emotionally, no matter what happens. And, you know, right before we leave here, I'll say that a lot of the stuff that's happening in the surface world is being driven by celestial events. So the reptilian overlords and their minions, however compartmentalized and out of the loop they may be, they don't realize that there's a timetable. And a lot of these ET races, the reptilians, and a lot of these fraternal orders, these secret society brotherhoods that have this metaphysical, magical capability, they know the timetable. And as long as we put ourselves in the best possible place, physically, emotionally, metaphysically, it doesn't matter what happens. We will rise above it, and we will take this planet with us. We will, you know, make this a better place than we found it.
And do you think
or we're born into?
Yes, I agree with that. And one more thing I'd like to add to that is that from what I'm seeing lately, I'm seeing that a lot of the alien abductees are actually breaking a lot of this programming just by the fact that they understand what you and I have been talking about tonight, about the fact that we are a crystalline DNA structure. We are a holographic mind. We are able to change everything with thought. And maybe, just maybe, we might be creating all this ourselves, you know?
Yeah, that's quite possible. And if we just really get into consciousness, get out of mind because it's too slow, and really tap into divine source and plug into divine source, rather, we'll be able to meet any contingency, any eventuality, don't matter. We, as a race, will advance spiritually, whatever the case may be. We will have a happy ending.
Yes. Yeah, I think so, too. Well, James, before we go, do you have any websites, or how would people contact you if you wanted them to contact you? Do you have a book coming out? Do you have a movie coming out? Anything exciting going on for you?
Yes, I've got some projects underway, writing projects, and I'm always interested in meeting others who've had these experiences. So I've got three different websites, but they're not the easiest ones to remember. So the easiest way to get a hold of me is to email me, and I'll give you the email address. It's okay. Vicksburg, Vicksburg at MSN.com. That's Victor India X-ray, Bravo Echo, Romeo Golf, Vicksburg at MSN.com. And write as long as an email as you want. Don't hold back. I won't judge anybody. Just speak from the heart, and then I'll always get back to you. I'll always get back with a proper email, not a form letter like some researchers do. Okay, so
right, okay, that's wonderful. And any books or movies or documentaries or YouTubes coming out?
Yeah, there's some writing projects that are underway, some of it will show up on the internet. Some of them are longer, more involved projects and writing projects, and that'll be coming down further down the road, not too long.
I'll tell you what, we're going to have you back soon in a couple of months, and when your books or writing projects come out, we'll have you on then. And folks, the Opus website is opus501.org. That's opus501.org. .org, like 501 genes, opus501genes.org. So there you go. And James, thank you so much for being with us. We'll have you back again. And everybody have a great evening and a wonderful week. And we'll see you next week here on the California MUFON Radio Show at Inception Radio Network. Good night, everybody. Thank you. We'll be right back.